Welcome to History's Nightfall podcast. This is Dan Jones, author, broadcaster, historical consultant on Nightfall and now, I think officially, podcaster. We're six episodes in, it must be true. I'm flicking through the contacts of my phone, ringing up the cast and crew from Nightfall to uncover more about this epic new historical drama. I've got to tell you this. It's the sixth time I've said it, but I'm going to say it again. Do not listen to this if you don't want to hear spoilers from the series up to episode 6. We're going to be talking about the series up to episode 6. I can't do that without giving at least some information. I don't want to ruin it for you. Everybody good? We're good. Okay, in this podcast episode, we're talking torture. All the beatings, batterings, and precarious toes-on-the-rock nastiness you can handle. Don't worry, I am fairly squeamish, so it might not actually be too much beatings, batterings, and precarious toes-on-the-rock nastiness. Put that aside, I'll be speaking to Tom Cullen, that's Landry. I'll be speaking to Simon Merrills, that's Tancred, about just how physically grueling and emotionally draining it was to film Nightfall's most grisly scenes. We'll also be finding out just how much of that blood on Tancred's face after he ran the gauntlet in episode 5 was real, and how much of it was Simon Merrill's own. But first, let's recap on everything we've just seen in Nightfall episode 6. Now, if you cast your mind back to episode 5, you'll remember that our Templar Master Landry went missing.
Rashid.
Whisked off for a meeting with some fairly nasty-looking gentleman with a bag over his head. Cut to episode 6, and the Templars realise they've got a problem. Where's the Master? Well, fortunately, as usual, Draper is on hand to tell us.
This was the Brotherhood of Light.
As it turns out, the Brotherhood of Light are pretty heavy. They think Landry knows where the Grail has got to, and they're going to use all the means at their disposal to find out, starting with making unkind remarks about Landry's mum.
What was your mother's name?
But moving pretty quickly on to a bit of would-be waterboarding. And then a spot of flambeing. And then, for good measure, stringing poor old Landry up with a chain around his neck and his toes on a rock. Oh, that's really not nice to see. But then again, maybe this is Landry getting a taste of his own medicine, because back at the temple, his best mate Tancred has hardly been having a good time either. Last time we saw him chained to a cross and beaten up. Now he's been groaning on the cross for what seems like forever, with a look of distinctly Christ-like suffering on his face. Tancred, all you've got to do is repent.
I do not repent.
Fine, have it your way. Over at the palace, meanwhile, de Nogaré is getting a pat on the head for his excellent work saving France from war. Not only is he being knighted,
he
also gets to be on first name terms with the king.
It's time you call me Philip.
In fact, it's all going famously for de Nogaré until he gets a visit from his creepy uncle Malraux.
He's the most dangerous man in all of France.
That's the bloke with a bear claw where his hand should be, who was pretty beastly to Landry when he was a boy.
There's nowhere to run! I'll find you, boy!
Well, since then, Malraux's got even worse, which is indicated from the fact that he's grown a really unpleasant beard. And he seems to be bringing bad vibes to de Nogaré.
Strong words, nephew.
Whose elevation to knighthood swiftly turns bad as Isabella finds out that
perhaps
he's been snooping on her from his peephole.
Private! Interesting choice of words!
He's sentenced to hang from
Louise.
The gibbet of Montfaucon.
You shall be hanged until death.
Is this the end for de Nogaré? Or does he have a creepy uncle with a bear claw? Well, I think we know the answer to that
one. De Nogaré!
Now, the medieval period certainly wasn't for the faint-hearted, and we see that right from the beginning of episode 6, when the whole royal family are assembled to watch a hanging, in this case of two English ambassadors, at the gibbet of Montfaucon. What is the gibbet of Montfaucon? Well, the gibbet of Montfaucon was a real thing. Montfaucon, meaning Mount Falcon, this was a hanging place outside the city of Paris. It was where common criminals came to meet their death. What we see in Nightfall is based very faithfully on what sketches and drawings we have historically of the gibbet of Montfaucon. That's why we see it at the beginning of the episode and at the end of the episode, two really strong historical bookends. Now, within episode 6 and episode 5, we see an awful lot of torture, and that's not just there to gross you out. This is a story, don't forget, about the end of the Templars, and in the big historical picture, torture played a very important role. We know from ample historical records that when the Templars were arrested, were accused of all the grotesque crimes that they were accused of in 1307 and 1308, hundreds, maybe even thousands of them were subjected to some of the most grisly and inhumane tortures available at the time. We have evidence from the Templar trials of one brother who said he'd been put into a pit that was so small he could barely take a step in any direction. The same brother said that he'd had his hands tied so tightly behind his back that blood had dripped from under his fingernails. The last master of the temple, Jacques de Molay, was brutally beaten. In fact, there's a record from his trial of him stripping off his shirt in front of a group of cardinals and showing them the scars he bore from the lashes he'd received. So there's ample evidence for high-ranking Templars in this period being tortured, even if it's not by the Brotherhood of Light. All of which brings us back to Landry. So let's cut in on a conversation I had with Tom about putting himself through all that pain.
I'd want to ask you something about the torture in the show in general and the number of unpleasant experiences Landry is put through, because you do kind of get beaten up on, right?
Yeah. It was a tough shoot. Yeah.
I mean, was it physically difficult?
Yes, it was physically the hardest thing I've ever done, because I was in every day doing something or other. I had a couple of days off where I was able to recharge, but there was, towards the end of the shoot, I worked 21 days in a row. I was doing like 17, 18 hour days sometimes, but a kind of 15 hour day minimum. And doing battle scenes in the morning and then going to, you know, just really, and going later in the afternoon, you know, going doing even more fight stuff or physically emotional stuff, or even just, I've never put my body through anything quite like that before. And it was mentally draining, because not only is it physically exhausting, and not only did they put Landry through it physically, they put him through it emotionally as well. And as a human being, sometimes that is also just as exhausting. You know, you want to commit yourself fully to whatever experience you're going through. But over a 7-month shoot, it's sometimes really hard to get your head off the pillow. But as soon as I was in work, I was having the time of my life. It really was like the best job. It was so fun.
I don't expect you to thank me for this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. There were quite a lot of tortures that were proposed for Landry that came through my little department of historical checking, the history police, I used to call myself. And the writer's room would quite often ring up and say, OK, what's the coolest torture from the Middle Ages that you know of? And I would sort of immediately have in mind, well, I know who this is going to be directed at ultimately, and have a vision of you. I think there was one occasion where you were having fire blown by a sort of professional fire breather onto your genitals.
That's correct, yeah.
Did that make it into the show?
It didn't.
It didn't make it into the show. Right, so we...
They wanted me to be hung upside down whilst they burnt my balls, yeah.
That was right. Landry's hanging upside down while a professional fire breather is breathing fire on his balls. And I said,
yeah.
I mean, I have two issues with this. One is a sort of human issue and my pastoral concern for Tom Cullen. And the second is, I don't think I ever read about that in any book.
No, I certainly didn't. No, but they... I was kind of like, when I first read that, I was like, you know what, guys, you know, like, listen, I'm not going to say no to anything, but I just feel like spending a day upside down is going to be a really, like, tough couple of days for me. Is there a chance we could, like, rethink this? And they were like, yes, no problem. So what they ended up doing was putting me into a tiny wooden box the size of my mother's womb. It was like being back in That is like being a child again, and putting drowned in water. And they wanted to fully submerge me. So I was going to be under for 20 seconds underwater. But they'd made this wooden box, you know, with a special little latch so that when I was submerged, they could get me out if I needed to. But what happened is every time I went fully under, the door would just open up because the special latch wasn't great. So I was like, oh, okay. So they're like, I'm really sorry, Tom, but we're going to have to do work. We're going to have to drill the lid of the box down. I was like, okay, so what happens if, and it's on, you know, it's on a winch. And I was like, so what happens if the winch breaks when I'm under and you can't get me back out again? Like, don't worry, it won't break. But yeah, I'm sure it won't. What happens if it does? They're like, we'll figure it out. It's okay. So there I am underneath the water with the lid screwed down, being fully submerged. That was pretty fun.
Do you think you did something?
I felt like Houdini.
Did you think you did something to annoy Dominic Minghella that you don't know about that he kept signing off all this?
Yeah, I don't know what he actually took me out to dinner to apologise before I read the script. He's like, okay, listen, I have to warn you, this is what we're going to be doing, just so you know. But okay, all right, okay, cool. And I was trying to gauge the look in his eye. He seemed to still quite like me, so I don't know. Maybe they just didn't like Landry.
Well, that could be it. Actually, I'm sure that's not the case. Now, Simon Merrill's had a similarly harrowing time filming one of Tancred's scenes, and for once, I'm not talking about him nearly drowning on the first day of principal photography. But it was still self-inflicted. What was your favourite scene across the whole series? I mean, we're going to be running this podcast across season one, so feel free to spoil away. What was your favourite scene to film, and the worst and the strangest, and whatever you like?
Well,
because Tancred goes through it. I mean, he no one has a particularly easy ride, right? But Tancred really, it's rough for him.
It is rough for him. And it was wonderful to, you know, go to those places, to be put in those situations of extremis, because he is put through extremis. And there are surprises along the way with his character about the choices he makes. And I had some dilemma at one point because of, you know, something he does. There's a book of rules about, you know, the way that a Templar knight has to live. And they're very, very detailed. They go down to, you know, everything he wears, how he eats, how he interacts with his brothers, what he says, whether he, you know, sits up in his saddle or not without being given permission to do so. Mm. So they lived by a very rigid code. And certainly of the larger infractions that could be committed, killing somebody under your protection is one of the worst things you can do. Certainly if it's a Christian, then it's a death sentence or it's excommunication. If it's one of the enemy, it's still something that you could be expelled from the order for. And he does this. He does this on temple grounds. And I found it difficult to understand why from one instance why he had decided to do this. But then once I latched onto the reason that it was to save the temple, to save the brotherhood, it was an easy run because I knew that was his prime motivator was to protect the brotherhood and their purpose. And then what came after was very extreme for the actor, for me, and for the character, because he will not repent his action, and so he is sentenced to carry a life-size cross, topless, and walk through a gauntlet of his brothers, who beat him, beat him over and over again, you know, with in, and they're in full mail. They have glove, mailed fists. And we shot that scene. Eventually, in the winter, we were meant to shoot it in the summer outside in the temple courtyard. But as you know, our set burnt down. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful craftsman just got on with it and rebuilt it. But this was 4 months later. So scenes that backed up that we were meant to shoot in the summer, we ended up shooting in the winter, like in -7 degrees. So
wow.
I was there in, you know, my Templar cloth trousers, and that was it, barefoot on hard frozen ground, topless, carrying this life-size cross. It wasn't, you know, oak, but it was still pretty heavy, actually. And dragging it along, chained to it, being mock-beaten by my fellow brothers, but nevertheless having to react to the beating. So I would stagger, I would swing myself and react to punches coming from my left side. But so, of course, I would smash, my own head would smash into the cross. Oof. Again and again and again. And I didn't feel it. I didn't feel it at all. Until afterwards, when I realized that the prosthetics, the wonderful prosthetics that had been put on to my face from the beating, as they were being taken off, the other side of my face had swollen. And it literally looked like bad prosthetics. It was so fat, oh my cheekbone came out like a golf ball. And that was real. And I realized that that had been from smashing my face into the cross, because you have to sell it. You have to sell something like that. So that was a long day. But I was very proud of it. And this is another example of the brotherhood afterwards, you know. Tom came up and he gave me a hug, because of course his character is the one ordering it.
Of course.
He's ordering that to be done. And in between takes, it's not the kind of thing really that I find as an actor in between takes. I want to just go and have a laugh and talk about what's for dinner. I had to keep myself in a certain state for the whole thing. And I'd just lock eyes with Tom or Porrig in between. Just before we'd go again, I'd go up to them, and they might be having Tom might be having a cigarette or talking, and I'd grab him and I'd say, "I love you, brother. I love you." And he wouldn't laugh in my face. He'd just look at me. And I'd carry that into the scene. And it was a very intense day. I mean, I don't want to say that it was something I remember as being hard to do. It was hard, but it was, they're the things you live for. You know, they're storylines that you hope you get. So it's stuff like that, really, stuff where we really delved into what it means to think that you give your life for the love of another. You know, what that would actually mean. And you have these intense emotions going through you, and you know, days like that were a gift.
I always love talking to Simon, but we do seem to be compiling quite a list of his near-death experiences here. Maybe we'll come back to that in a future episode of the podcast. But what I want to talk about now comes out of that conversation I just had with Simon, because it's all about the nature of Templar punishments. In episode 5, we see Tancred running the gauntlet when we have the Templar brothers lined up in two lines, and he has to stagger between them, dragging a cross over his shoulder, while each of them lashes out with his fists against him. Now, that isn't strictly from the rule of the Templars, but we have ample evidence of this or very similar punishments being used in military environments from as far back as Roman times to colonial era New York, and even 19th century Russia. And in its spirit and brutality, it isn't a million miles away from the punishments that are mandated in the real Templar rule. The real Templar rule is divided into three sections. There's the first section, which we talked about earlier in this podcast series, which is the monastic rule. It's the way that Templars should live. We have a section that's a military manual, how Templars should fight. But by far the largest section of the original rule of the Templars is concerned with what it calls penances, things the Templars could do wrong, and the punishments that were to be inflicted on wrongdoers. And what strikes you when you read the official Templar rule is just how many offences there were. You could be punished for everything from saying you didn't want to be a Templar. If you said that twice and other brothers heard you, you would be stripped of the habit and made to eat your food on the floor with the dogs for up to a year and a day. If you fought with another brother, a similar punishment could await you. If you went out of the temple and consorted with what the rule calls the Saracens, you could be expelled from the order forever. There was a whole long list of Templar sexual misdeeds, particularly pertaining to homosexuality. There's one massively long part of the rule which explains a case study of three Templars who'd been caught in bed with each other in a castle in the Holy Land. Well, one of them had tried to run away when they were found out, another was clapped in chains and died in the dungeon, and another one simply disappeared. And counterintuitively, one of the worst punishments of all was to be meted out to a Templar who had died but was found to have possessions, particularly money, on him. Templars were forbidden to have possessions of their own, and anyone who died with money on his person was forbidden a Christian burial, which was another way of saying you were going straight to hell. So, although the gauntlet, as I've said, is not in the Templar rule, I think that the very brutality and severity of it is absolutely in keeping with what we know about how the real Templars enforced military discipline. Now, in episode 6, there's one more example of Nightfall playing fast and loose with the Templar rules, and we hear that from Gawain when Tancred has been released from his dungeon.
By the Templar rule, as punishment for your crimes, your armor will be made into chains. You will wear the chains around your neck and wander for 1 year and 1 day.
No, he won't.
Now, Gawain obviously hasn't been reading his Templar rule, but Landry has, because he says...
Pilgrimage of chains is a penance for brothers who are permitted to return. Tancred is expelled, never to return.
And that's absolutely right. For the living, the worst punishment that could be imposed upon a Templar wasn't being stripped of the habit and made you eat your food on the floor with the dogs. It was being thrown out of the order, stripped of your uniform, sent back out into the real world with all the disgrace of having been kicked out of God's army resting on your shoulders.
There's a system of exchanging messages and relaying messages, a sort of inbox ping, if you will, in Nightfall, which operates around a system of just placing oranges in strategic locations.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I had a rather... I scratched my head about the oranges for a long time because I was called... during pre-production by our excellent first AD, Mark Taylor, who said he had a problem. He had a long list of historical questions, and there was one that was really bugging him, which was like, and he said, what's the historical significance of the orange? And I spent about a week researching the significance of oranges before coming to Prague in pre-production.
It's like a novel, isn't it?
Yeah.
The significance of oranges. Yeah.
The significance of oranges. Yeah, God, you could sell hundreds of thousands of copies of that.
I can see your name on the book, Dan. I can see
The Significance
it.
Of Oranges by Dan Jones.
Yes. Yes.
That should be the next one. Maybe that's the memoir. Maybe that's the yeah. diaries, like Alan Bennett's sort of diaries. I could write
yes,
a Nightfall
my
diary.
Life in film. My life as a historical advisor on Nightfall.
So regular listeners will know by now that the oranges we see cropping up time and again in Nightfall have really been playing on my mind. And actually, that started well back in the early days of pre-production. So while I had Simon on the phone, I wanted to see if he could add to what Tom had to say in the last episode of the podcast.
Well, I think it's... I mean, I'm with you, brother. I am with you. Because when we first read that way back in the day, we had a read-through and it said, stage, you know, Godfrey, Master Godfrey, turns, sees an orange sitting on a windowsill and goes immediately. And, you know... we giggled a bit because we didn't realize the significance of the orange immediately. But I suppose if you think about it, and even in later periods, Elizabethan periods, where, you know, there was a nest of spy networks and symbols and secret codes and ways of, just as there are now, you know, ways to notify spies to information drops or whatever. We bought it in the end because it seemed a very innocuous, simple method of saying, come now.
Come now.
Come now. It's a calling card of the Brotherhood of Light, and it's something that nobody else would think twice about.
And it's perhaps rich in vitamin C.
And yeah, unless they were thinking, God, how lucky to have come across an orange.
That's just what I fancied.
My teeth are falling out. I'm desperate for those vitamins. You know, we kind of bought it. And actually, it's very funny because this is the wonder of, you know, TV that maybe not everyone realizes that you can shoot a scene 6 months later and it'll be put way back in the first episode. And actually, there was a scene added involving the orange and Tom and me, Landry and Tancred, when he's just been, you know, made acting master because our master's disappeared after the moment of the orange. He's gone off because it's a message for him from the Brotherhood that we later find out.
I like that you slipped into Tancred voice when you said acting master there.
Acting master.
Acting master. Acting master.
Yeah. Yeah. And we shot, that was actually the last scene of the whole series that we shot.
Explaining the orange, really?
Well, I come up to him and say, I believe you're going to be made acting master.
Acting master.
He says, and we talk a bit, and then he says, and I found this. This is the last thing. He looked at this, and I found it. And then he just chucks it in the air like we didn't plan. Tom just said, afterwards, I felt like doing it. So he chucks it in the air. I catch it. And he slaps me on the back and goes, and I'm left looking at the orange and then looking out the window thinking about it. And that's the last thing we shot, even though it was snipped into the first episode that we shot, you know, 6-7 months before.
Presumably,
my worry was,
well, presumably
have we really changed? I mean, we felt like different people by the end of that 7 months, I can tell you. But it's actually seamless.
It does help. It does, because I saw a version of the pilot episode without that scene, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think that was in when it premiered at Dan and Cannes.
No.
And then it appears.
It
and, you, and you suddenly go, well, if Tancred's confused by the orange, I feel like legitimised what's the word? I feel like it's okay for me to be confused about the orange as well.
Yeah, your scepticism is placated by the fact that Tancred's a bit confused about it as well, yeah.
Simon Merrill's there, as always, making me feel actually really good about the fact that I'm at times totally confused. Now, we're getting to the end of this episode of the podcast, and it's time for your questions. As you know, I love answering your questions, whether sent to me on Twitter or Facebook or any other way you choose. And we've got a great question here concerning one of the kingdoms featured in Nightfall. It's come via Twitter, and it's from Victor Garcia Glez, with a full stop after it. I hope I've got his name right there. Victor, my apologies if I haven't. Victor says, hello, Dan. Hi. Would you be so kind as to tell me where I can find the quote-unquote Kingdom of Catalonia in the Middle Ages? I thought it was called the Crown of Aragon. Hashtag Nightfall at Nightfall Show. So, well, Victor, this is obviously a very good point. In the Middle Ages, there was no Kingdom of Catalonia. There was a Kingdom of Aragon, which covers roughly the geographical territory in which we find Catalonia in Nightfall. But the Kingdom of Catalonia that we see in the show is the invention of the writers. I guess we should probably try and speculate or explain why they did this. And I think from what I gleaned working on the show, we needed to come up with a kingdom, a fictional kingdom, in which to set a bunch of fictional events. Now, had the writers used the real Kingdom of Aragon, all of the storyline with Luis and Elena and the exploding chariots and so forth, which sprung from the fertile minds of the geniuses at work in the Nightfall writers' room, would have crashed directly into the facts of Aragonese history. For example, there is no King Hammaz II, who was on the throne of Aragon at that time, and so on and so forth. So the writers ultimately decided to create a fictional Spanish political entity that they could have fun with, which was unbound from real Aragonese history. So I hope that goes some way to explaining why in Nightfall we see Catalonia, whereas in the Middle Ages this region was in fact Aragon. Now, if you've got a question for us, please search for Nightfall or History on Facebook or Twitter, or tweet me directly at DG Jones. You can also rate and review this podcast on your podcast app, and if you leave a comment or question there, we will see it, and if we can answer it, then we will. And that brings us to a close. But what's coming up next? Well, in the next episode of the podcast, I'll be speaking to director and executive producer Douglas McKinnon about building the world of Nightfall. We've got the King, Ed Stoppard, on a great scene coming in the next episode of the show. And we've got Bobby Schofield, who's going to tell us all about playing the Templar recruit, Parsifal. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.